Hello and welcome back to Manga Kaiwa.
Hi, everyone. Yeah. So, I'm sorry for everyone who maybe had noticed a little issue with our last episode, being that the OSTs were not very clearly audible, let's just say. That's probably the nicest way to put it. We really apologize. I guess we had a solution that didn't quite... work out as well as we thought it would. Damn, sorry about that sneeze. But I mean, hopefully we'll be able to repost it at some point with like some more kind of heavily edited portions so that you guys can actually hear the audio clearly. Probably will be even clearer than it would have been had our plan worked out, because it'll be a direct MP3 that we'll download. But yeah, hopefully you can forgive us for now. Hopefully you we're still able to appreciate the analysis that we did, especially if maybe you've already watched that series and you have experience kind of like watching the visuals while experiencing the OST, et cetera. So maybe it wasn't that bad, but we will definitely try to repost that at some point. Just can't guarantee.
What. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice. All right. But you know how it is. This week, we're not doing anything top 10-ish, but we will be doing a more kind of conversation-based, discussion-based video. And this is actually a topic I've been wanting to talk about for a very long time. Because like, I guess we've kind of established that I'm a bit more of a manga reader and Ben is a bit more of an anime watcher, although we do dabble in the other things. Like, for example, I just watched my first anime in a while yesterday, which I'll talk about because I have to, because it was good. But I guess the point is that a manga series particularly, and you know, especially considering that manga series do serve as a source material for a lot of anime that are adaptations of those series, is usually an incremented format. Like I can't think of any other ones that isn't either a weekly, a monthly, a bi-monthly, you know, some kind of set time interval, excluding hiatuses and like people who just have problems and can't work. I guess the point is that that causes issues, because you gather a fan base, you gather a following. You know, some of these series run for years, decades in some case. And then they have to somehow bring everything that they've done to a close. And that requires an incredible level of foresight and just narrative awareness. Not that I've ever, you know, had this experience myself, but I mean, it's clearly one of the most difficult aspects of making a story, especially anime and manga, which, you know, even if you're talking about the anime, which may be released in batches, it's still incremental. Like, I guess you could probably exclude very kind of short OVAs, or just like, for example, just sets sort of just batches that are released all at once. For example, some Watanabe's works, which I know Ben is going to mention later in this video.
As I always do.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's definitely very appropriate this time, because Watanabe doesn't drag things out, and he often, like, I assume he probably has a very solid outline, you know, of everything, and then he just does it, and then he releases it. I guess my point is, they're probably almost done or completely done with everything before they release the first episode. You get what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I don't think they're doing it batch by batch, is I guess the point.
I would assume that he probably does have the ending in mind when he sets out to create the series. Yeah.
Like, not even in mind, like, actually, like, I would imagine he probably has all the episodes ready when they start airing. Like, I don't know, that's just a speculation, obviously, but just to say that some, you know, situations, some conditions are ideal for ending a series, but mostly, especially when it comes to manga and the anime that are adapting those manga series, like in Weekly Shonen Jump or any kind of monthly magazine from the big publishers, it's very hard, you know, to make an ending that both satisfies you as an author, I'm supposing, but then also actually, like, you know, gratifies most people. Because to be honest, and this is, I guess, where we're moving into the first kind of main section of this episode, which is controversial endings and examples of them and kind of like our thoughts and our takes on these endings, why they were kind of like received the way that they were, and of course, what we thought of them. So Ben, yeah. I don't mind, but I can probably go first on this one, and then like we can sort of go from there. But one example that I think is very, very prominent is the ending of Bleach. So Bleach obviously is considered one of the most successful manga of all time because it, you know, I mean, not because, but I guess it, in correlation with the fact that it was also very long running. I mean, 74 volumes is an insane number of volumes. I mean, for any series, really. And I mean, it's, you know, a typical example of those trademark Jump series that run very long because they're beloved. I mean, there's no way of denying that. Yes. You know, maybe there was the story and that did fit that volume count. But Jump obviously wants to make money, so they're going to push it to go longer. And as the series gets stretched longer and longer and longer, it becomes very difficult for the author to maintain that balance of filling that space and not making it like this thin kind of like, oh shoot, we're kind of dragging this out. But then also knowing that at some point, all those threads that he's spinning, like referring to Kubo, he's going to have to tie them together. I actually think Kubo does that. I think the ending wasn't controversial because of any plot threads not being addressed or just kind of dropped plot sequences, right? I think it was the pacing of the ending, which I think, I don't even think, I know that's what a lot of people criticized the ending for. I mean, it is pretty well known that Kubo does stick to the fact, he stands by the fact that he ended the series in a way that was satisfactory to him and that he was he was content with, let's just say. But obviously, you know, like whether it was content with him or not, or, you know, there was some kind of pressure from Jump and his editors, etc., to end the series, I'm not addressing that. That's obviously a whole debate. I mean, most people say that, you know, that's not true these days because it's been disproven, but you know, you never know if, even if it wasn't officially released as information, as like news. Kubo, I think, definitely made a rushed ending. I'm not saying I didn't like the ending, but I think the ending is such a mixed bag, mostly of good things, but of, you know, a good deal of kind of not so good things either. Namely, the pacing of the final few chapters. And I think the use of Deus Ex Machina, which was really kind of distasteful, in my opinion, in this sequence, probably one of my least favorite aspects of the Thousand Year Blood War arc. But I want to kind of really emphasize, I think one of the best epilogues ever is of Bleach's ending, my opinion personally, because this is a long running series that ends with a realistic and satisfying kind of closure to these characters, showing that not all is good and well, but they have reached a happier place where they've resolved a lot of their dynamics, you know, and settled down, especially in the case of Ichigo. But the way that, okay, I guess we're gonna have to announce this now, this is obviously going to be a spoiler heavy recording, but the fact that Uryu pulled that arrow out of nowhere was a bit weird. I will not deny that. I thought it was a bit of a Deus Ex Machina, even if you could see that Kubo was building it up to a certain extent. It wasn't completely out of nowhere, but it was mostly out of nowhere. And I personally think that's because if Kubo had a few more chapters to explain the arrow, or not even to explain the arrow, but to kind of ease it into the mix of like the chaos of that final few moments, right? Those final few moments, it would have felt so much more natural and less forced. Again, I want to emphasize, I'm not saying Kubo was forced or anything, because I know that's a pretty actually sensitive subject. Like, I mean, yes, there's no official recording to it of it that's been established. In fact, it's probably now labeled as kind of misinformation that Kubo was like pressed by his editors. But I guess the point is, Kubo saw the sales. He saw that his series was long. He saw that he wanted to end it. He saw that he wasn't feeling good. Obviously, there's going to be a bit of kind of pressure, even if it's self-imposed, to end the series, which does, you know, probably pose as a possibility or a possible reason why the pacing was so out of whack at the ending. I love the ending of Bleach, actually, especially the epilogue, but the conclusion of the Blood War arc is not my favorite. That is for sure, and I can see why. And I think that is, you know, again, because of that long burn culture of manga writing, which, you know, really is taxing. And the fact that these mangaka are only human and they're going to take every opportunity, or the opportunity when they want to stop serializing.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I'll definitely add that, you know, it definitely is a trend you can see where, like, the longer a series goes on, like the, you know, the more challenging it is like to end it in a way that feels satisfying for the majority of people. And of course the author, because, you know, as the series goes on, you know, the author like has to keep building it up and, you know, adding all these different like plot threads, like you said. And so like, to end it in a way that like, you know, feels satisfactory and like, you know, conclusive, you know, and having this like sense of closure, you know, it is a real challenge, you know, and it can't, you know, be done by just anyone, obviously. But yeah, so, all right. So moving on to, my examples of sort of like almost like incomplete feeling endings in a sense. First off, I actually have Dragon Ball Z, like the original ending, more specifically of the Dragon Ball manga, you know, not counting Super or anything like that. Where we see the 10-year time skip after the end of the Buu saga, and we see Goku, the protagonist, obviously flying away with Oob, who is the reincarnation of Kid Buu, who was like the final boss of the aforementioned Buu saga. So honestly, this ending, you know, and on its own, like, isn't, I wouldn't call it bad. I mean, in fact, I honestly do kind of like it for what it is, you know, Goku, the idea that Goku is training this, you know, training this reincarnation of a former enemy to, you know, be an ally and, you know, become like one of the Z fighters. I think it's a, you know, I think it's a cool concept in, you know, conception, but I feel like the ending as a whole just doesn't feel very complete. You know, Goku is just like flying off with this, you know, kid he just met really at the World Martial Arts Tournament. And, you know, he's leaving his friends and family behind, which, I mean, is of course, I guess, typical for someone like Goku and his character. But I feel like the tournament itself was just this huge tease because, you know, in the brackets, Goku and Vegeta were actually supposed to, Vegeta being his main rival, they were actually supposed to fight in one of the matches. And of course, that didn't happen because Goku immediately flew away with Oob, you know, once they had, you know, stopped fighting in their match. But I feel like it was just kind of like this huge tease because, you know, the entirety of like the Z section of the series really has been building up this like dynamic between Goku and Vegeta as these, you know, ultimate rivals that, you know, that are always trying to, you know, one up each other and they ultimately bring out the best in each other. And I feel like we were sort of robbed almost in the sense of this final battle between Goku and Vegeta, which of course, you know, they did fight in the Buu saga as well. But I feel like, you know, just to put things into perspective, this ending took place 10 years after, you know, the end of the Buu saga. And you would assume that in those 10 years, Goku and Vegeta were, you know, kept up their training and, you know, and just like, you know, they were also, you know, they didn't stop training. And I feel like it would have been just so satisfying to see them, you know, have this final battle where they're just, you know, they're just giving it everything and showing the results of that
is one of the greatest parts of Z, as I've heard it, of the dynamic between those two, which I guess is, it feels like sort of missing the point at the end is what I'm kind of hearing from you, right? Kind of like that. I guess it's, do you know, like, Toriyama has commented on the ending at all? Like, are you aware of that? I mean, if not, it's, I mean, yeah, just know, but.
I mean, I'm not sure if I know exactly what Toriyama has said on the ending, but I feel he was content with it at least because, you know, there's also the fact that there's these common rumors within the about the series that Toriyama actually originally intended to, you know, either end the series after the Frieza saga or the Cell saga. And, you know, he was always just kind of, you know, pushed to keep going because of the huge, you know, the continuing of success of the series, you know, similar with other artists, of course. And, but yeah, ultimately that is the case with the ending. And again, it's not that I think it's a bad ending necessarily. It just feels, you know, a bit incomplete, a bit like, you know. Yeah.
I mean, I think incompleteness, you know, is really synonymous or very close to, not synonymous, but very close to, I guess, the term that I was using, which is sort of like this unsatisfactory, this discontent feeling that you get when you're finished. I think that's true. But I think what's really interesting that you said is that idea that you didn't dislike the ending, but I guess the vibe I was getting from what you were saying is critically, you can't give it the green check, right? Like, I think that's a really important distinction, because Bleach, just going back to that example, I really liked the ending. Like, even the end of the Thousand Year Blood War arc, that those final few double pages with, you know, Zangetsu coming out of the kind of broken Bankai, those are incredible moments. Like, they feel good, but just contextualized, or I guess considered in context, critically, you can't really say very good things about it. I think that's a really important distinction to make, because no matter what, an ending is an ending. And if it's an ending of a really good series, you know, you're gonna feel sad that it ends. And as long as the series doesn't make you kind of frustrated, or I guess, you know, feels like let down by like what it did, if it like betrayed itself, as long as that isn't the case, I think, you know, you're going to probably like the ending if you like the series itself. That's, I guess, my perspective on that. Yeah. So Ben, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Was there anything else like you kind of wanted to comment on the DBZ ending, or should we move on to my second kind of example? Because I would like to sort of do that as well.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think that, let's move on to yours. Yeah.
I think that's also a problem. Like, you know, for me, I kind of talked a while on the Bleach example, but I guess the point is I think a lot of these endings, it's really hard to put into words what is bad about them, because what you would have liked to see is really the only thing you can think of. I think a lot of these endings are bad, quote unquote, not because they did something, but they didn't do something in our eyes. I think that's an important thing, because a lot of the times, I think, especially these days when the community is growing so rapidly and it's become so ginormous, especially compared to what it was even a few years ago, like there are so many more people that basically have the opportunity, or I guess like there's enough people that there's a lot of the times like a kind of movement when a series ends, a manga series or an anime series or whatever, that sort of, I guess, expresses a sort of fantasy that they had about the ending of the series, which is an important distinction, right? Because the author is also a huge part of that. Their desire for whatever ending they want is very much important. In fact, I would say it's probably more than 50% of the importance. This is their series. And if you've trusted them this far, you trust them for the ending as well. I guess the point is, with the ending, it's not like they're going to come back and fix whatever things you maybe didn't like that much. It's the end. But yeah, I guess that was sort of a weird tangent, but the next example I want to give, and Ben, I know you haven't read this series, but I've talked about it a lot, and I really would recommend you trying to read it at some point, even though it is a bit zany, like very, and a bit over the top. Gantz is a pretty long series, 37 volumes, and it does have a very controversial ending. I think most people think it's like the worst ever. I've heard people say it's crushing, because a lot of these older manga fans that have been like that were following it throughout the 2000s, they just hated the ending because it was just so dry to them, I guess. Like, it were not dry, it felt really stunted, like it felt chopped off at a moment that it shouldn't have been at, which I personally disagree with, but I can see the kind of stance of a lot of these people that kind of represent that argument, let's just say. So I guess I'll give a bit of context, and Ben, I'll try not to spoil too much, because I think you might get to it at some, who knows, I'm not saying you will, but I think you might get to it someday. But the final arc is, you know, very typically, and I mean, I guess not so typically for a seinen necessarily, but certainly for like a shonen and stuff, even though Gantz is a seinen, the final arc is like a big kind of like really high stakes end of the world situation where things are going down and the consequences of losing or certain actions are massive, much higher than they were previously. And throughout this whole mix, we have this actually pretty beautiful, and I mean, just referring to the arc as a whole, which is pretty long as well. I mean, it's not short, but it isn't, it's not long. It's pretty long. Let's just leave it at that, right? And so essentially what happens in this arc is that a person that's very important to the protagonist, who has the power, the ability to fight this final threat, is captured by that threat. or at least gets swept up in it in a way that puts her in extreme danger. And the parallel is this big apocalyptic situation, kind of parallel to the kind of personal struggle of the protagonist and the fact that he's motivated to take part in this final kind of big battle, partially, at least mostly, because of the fact that the consequences could mean death for his lover. And I think that's actually a really good setup, especially on paper, and it is executed quite well as well. But I think most people didn't like it because it really did tie into the ending. It felt a bit, I guess, too kind of old style poetic. It was like not poetic in the not so good way, the kind of clicheness of that. I think a lot of people, and I guess I'll just describe the ending. Essentially, the threat is eliminated and the protagonist and the kind of semi-deuterogonist, let's just say, reunite with their loved ones, like in a kind of really kind of almost dramatic, kind of like they come up on the shore of this beach and they're hugging their loved ones because they were there waiting for them. Then it just ends. I think like that's a beautiful moment, and I don't think anybody can deny that it is, but it just ends. I think, you know, I kind of try to imagine what Oku Hiroya, the author of this series, was thinking when he was doing this. And I think it's almost like he was questioning what he would do past this point. And I think that's like I don't know, I don't want to kind of psychoanalyze him. And I don't even know if this is true. I don't know if this is what he was thinking. But I personally, my theory is that he was kind of thinking, well, what am I going to do? Like, it was kind of like this overbearing feeling of, okay, this is beautiful, but how do I not mess this moment up with what comes after that? And I guess his conclusion, in my theory, let's just say, was I'm not even going to do anything after that. I'm just going to leave it at this, which pissed a lot of people off because they were like, okay, great, they're reunited. That gives us closure for the stakes. Like, there's no danger anymore. But these characters, what are we going to do right now? I personally think it gave me enough closure, but I can definitely understand that it was just the bare minimum. It was like the bare minimum of an ending. Like, I think that's the perfect way to describe it. It's the bare minimum. Everything was closed, but like just like really by a hair's breadth. And, you know, I think that's another thing to point out. Like, maybe people do like to have time for the ending to sink in, which I think is an issue that plagues a lot of series. Yeah. Gantz is great. You should read it. And again, any of these series, even if they have a controversial ending, like I said, if you like the series, you're going to probably like the ending, even if you can't critically acknowledge it as really good or anything.
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny you mentioned that ending, because I feel like, at least how you described the ending, I feel like it's actually very similar in nature to the one I'm about to talk about, which is my second example of Yu Yu Hakusho. So Yu Yu Hakusho is a great series, no doubt. It's a series that preceded Hunter x Hunter by Yoshihiro Togashi. And and overall, it's a very solid series, but I feel like, you know, and this is, you know, a common thing that's shared among, you know, the fan base, that the ending does feel rushed. And I think Togashi, the author, actually acknowledges how, you know, it was a bit of a rushed ending. I think the anime differs from the manga in some aspects, but I haven't actually researched that fully. But anyway, so the ending actually ends in a very similar way, with like the protagonist Yusuke sort of, you know, reuniting with his loved ones, you know, Keiko, who is his romantic interest, and they're all sort of just reunited on this, you know, just like sort of happy ending, which is, you know, nice. It's, you know, it's like a good, it's, you know, it's a good spirited ending. But I feel like, you know, it just, again, it just feels, you know, pretty incomplete, because like Yusuke, we know that from the arc beforehand that Yusuke went to the demon realm, which, as we know, Yusuke himself is part demon, and he participated in this, like, you know, this like sort of like worldwide tournament of the demon realm. And so we saw the conclusion of that tournament, and, you know, while it was, you know, satisfactory, you know, we just, after that, we just kind of go on to the ending with Yusuke reuniting with his friends. And I feel like it's like, you know, there's this sense that, you know, when we're not being shown just, you know, as much as we could have been shown, right? We didn't really see, you know, what Yusuke was doing in the demon realm after that moment. And, you know, there's also the fact that, you know, well, okay, that's great. Yusuke is, you know, he's with his friends again, But what is he going to do now? Is he just going to stay in the human realm and, you know, live out the rest of his days as a human? Is he going to go back to the demon realm and, you know, become like some kind of like king or whatever, you know, take the place of Ryzen, his biological ancestor? And, you know, it just, it kind of leaves these, this like multitude of questions that, you know, don't really get answered ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to spoil anything for JoJolion, but that really, the issues that you, like the critical issues that you pointed out, very similar to the JoJolion issues, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing is that this is like more of a narrative problem, more than a pacing problem, or just like a content problem. It's more of a content problem. It's like, literally, there were some things that didn't quite make sense because certain consequences of certain plot threads never got addressed. Is that sort of like what you meant? Like, it's just like, okay, but this can't stay like this because he's the kind of answer, the descendant of a demon king and all that kind of stuff. Is that sort of what you mean?
Kind of, yeah. It's just like it just left, you know, I think too many things, you know, unexplored ultimately, you know, which were kind of being built up by the final arc, but, you know, never really explored upon in the ending ultimately.
I'm curious though, because there's like a difference between unexplored and like unaddressed.
I mean, unexpanded, I meant to say.
Yeah. Okay. Because I think it's a really interesting point that you kind of even use that word, because unexplored can also be dissatisfactory. And I think that's a perfect way to use Gantz's ending, right? Like unexplored, the exploration is, for me, it's like the above what you need to do. It's above the bare minimum. The address is like what you need to do for a conclusive ending. I feel like Gantz, it addressed all its plot threads, in my opinion. I mean, okay, besides one big one that everybody knows, but that's kind of obviously a retcon. But I think the problem was that it didn't explore further. So yeah, I think I guess what you're saying with Yu Yu Hakusho is that there were some unexpanded or unexplored or unaddressed. Like, were they unaddressed, do you think? Like, just like they were just kind of left, like kind of gaping hole, not gaping holes, but like holes. Like, would you call it a plot hole, is I guess the point.
I would say so. I mean, I wouldn't say like plot hole. I wouldn't go to that extent, but I feel like just, I mean, unexpanded, really, unexplored, like, aspects.
By plot hole, I didn't really mean, like, sorry to interrupt you, but, like an inconsistency or a contradiction in the narrative, but rather, like a plot thread that was cut short, sort of. Like, it was just, like, it needed to keep going in order to meet.
In a sense, yeah, basically.
One at the end, yeah. Yeah, it's, that's, I think, a very common issue that people have with a lot of endings. And I think it's probably very common for longer series as well, especially because, like, you know, just longer, even the Yu Yu Hakusho is 19 volumes long, which is pretty short in the grand scheme of shonen. I mean, it's still a good length, and I mean, it's still a story that has a lot of time that occurs within it, if you get what I'm saying. So yeah, I mean, it's an issue, I will say, like, ending a series is an issue. Not just because of the industrial real life circumstances of these people and the fact that, you know, they have a limited stamina and that, you know, when you see the end, you're going to rush towards it. Like, when you see this, the end line, the finish line, you're going to go to it. Even if you don't really logically think that's the right thing to do, if you're that exhausted, you're going to rush towards it. And it doesn't matter, like, you're not going to keep your form while you're running. Sorry for the track and field references. I don't even know if this is correct, but, you know, I guess the point is, like, it's the kind of the same thing as, like, I don't know. It's just like, if you know that the thing is going to end, you can't really help yourself but kind of react in a kind of lacking in quality way, as I guess what I'm trying to say, which I think is a very, like, understandable issue to have. And I think that not only that, but some people just can't keep going because of health issues or because of circumstances that they're in. And also, some people just, like, you know, I guess it's hard, like, to just pull everything together in a way that doesn't feel awkward. Because I think the problem with weekly serialization is that you can't go back and erase what you wrote in a chapter, like, 3 years ago, even though it doesn't flow with what you have right now. you either choose to bring that back in and make it feel awkward, or just leave it out and have a gaping hole, a retcon basically, or let's say a plot hole. It's an issue. There are so many ways you can mess up an ending, is I guess what my point is. And ending something successfully is just very hard. You have more obstacles to go over. There's not really anything going for you when you end a series. You kind of have to make it go for you. I don't know if that makes sense, but I think that's a huge issue, especially these days, because it riles a lot of fans up, like to an extent to which they'll make unreasonable claims, and I think not have an understanding for the sheer challenge that is ending a series, especially a long-running one. I know I keep saying that, but it's really something I think needs to be emphasized. And I guess the last kind of part of this episode that I think we wanted to address was the successful finales, like finales that we felt more complete when we kind of experienced them, etc. And Ben, do you mind actually starting this one? Because I saw what you kind of told me what you were going to talk about. I'm really curious as to what your thoughts of them are. Would you mind going ahead with the first kind of example?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So going into the endings, I thought were really satisfactory. My first example would be Gintama, which concluded pretty recently. I think, well, the manga concluded like earlier, obviously, but we recently saw the release of Gintama, the final, which, you know, acts as the ending to the series. And I just thought it was, you know, just true to, like, you know, the sort of nature of the series, and, you know, just feeling, you know, just like satisfactory, because I feel like I feel like the way, you know, the author did this, Hideaki Sorachi, was very, you know, genius, honestly. I feel like, you know, because he did this, like, he wrapped up the series in, like, these two, like, you know, sort of sections, I guess, like the final battle, which is, you know, between Gintoki and his allies, and, you know, Utsuro and his forces. And I think that one, that does wrap up pretty nicely. I mean, I think it, you know, it was a good, you know, definitely a good conclusion to that battle. And, you know, and then, like, it goes on to, like, sort of, like, you know, explore, like, you know, the aftermath, like, you know, what everybody is doing, like, it has been up to since then, which, you know, I guess is pretty typical with, like, epilogues of series. But I feel like, you know, it doesn't go the cliche of route of, you know, having, like, you know, for example, like, pairing up, like, characters together and, like, having them have kids, like, you know, and I think they actually comment on that. Like, they comment on, like, how they're, you know, avoiding the cliche. Fashion. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, it just feels so satisfactory, because ultimately ends with, you know, Gintoki, Kagura, and Shinpachi, you know, the odd jobs trio, just, like, going out and continuing to do their odd jobs, like, and showing that, you know, it's like, okay, so they haven't, so at their core essence, yes, they've, you know, experience these, you know, these sort of, like, battles, like these ultimate battles with the world at stake, but ultimately, you know, at their core essence, they're still the same people, basically the same goofballs. And, you know, people might say, oh, well, that doesn't show good character development, but I feel like Gintoki's character is just, like, so well expanded upon on the series. And, you know, we're just kind of, like, you know, we're with Gintoki as, like, you know, as an adult, basically, as a grown man who has experienced, you know, been through the typical years of a shonen protagonist, and which I think is very unique in that Gintama does that. And I feel like, you know, it's this ending that just feels, you know, just, like, satisfying as a, you know, as a reader / watcher of the series.
Yeah, and I think, Sorry to interrupt you, but I feel like it's, like, the similar effect to when you have, like, a sunrise, you know, like, it's the walking out into the sunrise kind of ending, but, like, in a much more poetic way, is, I guess, what I'm saying. I know that's, like, they sound super cliche, but it's sort of like the chaos is over, the conflict has been quelled, we're back to what we were at the beginning, just changed people, we're changed by that conflict, and we're coming back to the returning point, we're coming back home, sort of like that homecoming at the end of a series, but, you know, you know, we're not forgetting what we just went through and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Is that, I mean, again, I have to watch Game Time. I'll read. I just have to, but is that sort of right? To a certain extent, I don't know.
Yeah. I would say something like, you know, just kind of like, yeah, I mean, there is really this elements of a sunrise where, you know, it gives a sense where, like, you know, they've like experienced, you know, the final arc has completed and characters, you know, I mean, for them, it hasn't ended. They're just, you know, they're going on into their next adventures, their next jobs. They're on the jobs, and, you know, it just feels satisfactory, you know. It doesn't feel incomplete at all. And which it also, you know, I'd also like to add that, you know, it's funny because we discussed like how, like, you know, like with long-running series, authors sort of run into this, you know, into these problems with the ending where, like, you know, they have to like tie up like all these different like plot threads and whatnot. And I feel like Sorachi, the author, kind of does this in this, you know, pretty comedic way. So like after we see like the ending with, you know, Gintoki, Kagura, and Shinpachi running off to their next job, we're actually treated to this like post-credits scene like in the movie where they're all like, the characters are all in this like classroom, and like it's like this huge Q&A with Sorachi, the author, who, you know, is actually represented by a gorilla, as that's kind of like his avatar, basically. Like,
Shonen Jump, and just the avatars of some of these authors are just whack sometimes, I swear.
Yeah, but anyway, so Sorachi is there in his gorilla form. It's just like this, it's like this huge, like, you know, comedic Q&A about different questions like people had like that about the series over time, you know, which are given by the characters, and it just feels so satisfactory because, you know, it's like,
that's great,
this is at its core Gintama. This is Gintama in its purest essence.
Just, well, like, yeah, it's owning itself, basically. It's owning that it is not just a battle shonen, but also of the comedy series. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I know, you know, of course, it doesn't appeal to everyone, but I honestly just love it so much. I feel like it does the comedy so well, and it's like, you know, it's like this reward for, like, you know, it just feels so rewarding, you know, as an ending for the series.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the problem as well. Like, it's not just the author doing the, like, running the race when they're doing a long-running series, or just a series that takes, you know, an extended period of time in general. It doesn't have to take years or decades. Like, yes, they're pulling the weight, basically, but they're not the only ones doing this race. There are the readers and the audience that are supporting them who are running with them. And they also need a reward at the end, which is, again, that balance of the author and the reader, or the audience, I guess, just feeling mutual satisfaction under the ending, which is, I guess, I don't know if this is something you would agree with, but an advantage a comedy series has, because it can almost like just make a kind of comedic ending, like a conclusion of a certain plot thread that if the series took itself more seriously would just feel awkward ending. Like, you know what I'm saying? I think that's kind of cool. Do you know if Sorachi actually, like, that was his voice in the ending? Do you know if that was...
Oh, no, he wasn't actually talking. The girl was just, you know, making, like, gorilla noises.
Right.
They just kind of understood.
Right, that would be epic, though, if Sorachi just, like, got, like, some voice acting lessons and...
Yeah.
I mean, why not? He seems like that kind of dude, but maybe I'm making assumptions that I shouldn't.
Yeah, I think he's a pretty mysterious guy. I don't think at least to my knowledge, I actually don't think there are any like photos of him on the web. I mean, there might be, but like, you know, if there are, it's like very few, and we really only know him like through his like gorilla avatar, basically. But yeah.
Gosh. Okay. So we've kind of established kind of, I guess, you know, an example. And I think an example whose kind of format is often, I think reoccurring. I would be confident in using that word in a lot of satisfactory endings. This sort of like, you know, things have ended, but most things keep going. We're continuing. And especially in a shonen series, it's this sort of like this solidarity, this resilience of keeping going despite all that has happened, which isn't always how series end. It isn't always pulled off well, but I think it's quite good. when it is pulled off well, obviously. It's a very preferred format for an ending, I would say. And I say format because, yeah, like I said, there are multiple series I can think of that try and sometimes succeed, I guess, in ending in that way. Or, you know, again, I haven't experienced Gintama, but obviously, Ben, you have. And from what you say, that's sort of what I'm getting. The series I want to talk about is Inuyashiki. And I think this is actually a really good time because it's by the same author as, you guessed it, Gantz. So it's sort of like, I guess, a bit of a cheeky parallel on my part, if you will. I love saying it that way. kind of showing how Inuyashiki is sort of like an improvement on a lot of the things people did not like about Gantz. I'm saying people because I personally wasn't bothered by it, like I said, but I can see why. And Inuyashiki, again, this is a bit of a spoiler. And Ben, I think you really would like this series, especially because it's shorter than Gantz and thereby is a lesser commitment. I think you would really like it. It's very similar to Parasite, I would say, like just vibe-wise. And also, I think it's the same studio. Don't quote me on that. I don't know if it's Madhouse. But essentially, Inuyashiki is a story of two people with completely different circumstances and completely different conditions that, you know, justify or don't justify what they do. I mean, obviously, they like, okay, I'll just stop beating around the bush. So the antagonist is a young boy. The protagonist is an elderly man, or at least a man who looks elderly, who is also quite old. That's complicated. But essentially, they both receive these godlike abilities. And the young boy decides to use them in very destructive ways, while the old man decides to use them in very, very altruistic ways, very kind of morally good, or at least, you know, how it's commonly regarded, morally good ways. And they obviously clash because the destructive tendencies of one of them interferes with the objectives of the other, which kind of, you know, drags on. And I don't want to say drags on, really. That kind of feels weird because the events of the series are beautiful and they are worth talking about. Just right now, they're not really kind of, I guess, relevant to the ending in the way that I'm talking about it. They are, but I don't know. I'm kind of getting off track. But the finale is the convergence of these two entities with completely different approaches to using the same abilities. And not only is the setting amazing and like just the isolation of these two, I guess I'll just spoil it because it's just sounds epic too. They're on the moon because like they can. Like they're on the moon, right? And there's this meteorite that's about to destroy the planet. They're on the moon and they're trying to they're not even on the moon. They're on the meteorite. What am I saying? But it's just like, you know, it's an epic setting. And it really sets this really dramatic tone for a series that in many ways is a very typical superhero series, a very superhero-like format in the sense that there's this antagonist, one antagonist, which, you know, gets rid of the issue of having to focus on multiple antagonists, and one protagonist. And this kind of really simplifies it down to this really almost stereotypical, I'm not cliche, but I would say very blueprint superhero story format. And you have this epic setting that really almost like owns that simplicity. And it's like, you know, things are about to go down. And then we get this kind of subversion moment where tropes and expectations are subverted when Inuyashiki, the main character, who is this altruistic old man, basically talks to this younger kid who has been wronged in so many ways, just as much, or not just as much, but, you know, in some of the same ways he has been wronged by society and by people, etc. He's lost so much, not just because of himself and his tendencies, but, you know, because he was pushed to use those tendencies in the destructive ways he was because of society in a certain way. And, you know, there's this heartfelt interaction between these two completely different people and a moment of understanding where you're kind of thinking to yourself, what, like, these are not like black or white representations of evil anymore, or evil and good, like we thought, because it was a superhero story. They're so nuanced, especially the antagonist. I will say that the protagonist is amazing, but the antagonist is definitely the star in this situation narratively. And essentially what happens, and this is kind of where I really have to try to avoid spoilers, is a very unexpected sort of loss, a sacrifice by the main character in order to kind of avoid this threat of this meteorite. And it's I think the beauty in this ending is that it extends beyond just the narrative events and to us. In order to fully acknowledge the ending, we need to acknowledge the sacrifice that this character's made, who we would, like, I can't think of a single person that would not want this character to have a good closure. And the sacrifice that he makes does not allow for that, for obvious reasons. And so that kind of, like, frustration is really beautiful in the sense that it transcends the story itself. And we have to accept it if we want to, you know, basically accept the closure that is given to us by the ending, which is mostly positive, with the sacrifice of this old man yielding some very heart-warming results for his family and for many other people. Particularly for one of his family members, this is one of the best parts of this manga, I swear, particularly because of one of his family members who had a very close dynamic with him, who their dynamic was probably one of the most drastically developed aspects, like that was present at the beginning of the story as well. Inuyashiki is great. And I think that the most kind of stunning thing about it is that the approach that it takes to the ending is very similar to Gantz, not in the sacrifice sense, because Gantz does also have a lot of different characters, which would have made that a bit difficult. I guess to have the sacrifice have the same weight as it did in Inuyashiki. But the fact that it's like the sentimental ending, it's not like a end all be all, like all the plot threads are put together, because it's a 10 volume series. There's only so many plot threads that there are, which again makes it a bit easier. This is an example of a non long running series probably having an advantage when it comes to ending itself. That sounded weird, but but ending. And so essentially we have this really heartfelt ending that feels reminiscent to what I guess some people argue Oku attempted but did not succeed in kind of pulling off with Gantz. But he does here, which I think shows some development as an author as well, in all honesty. And it just, it's really kind of like bittersweet, you know, in the most pure, like sheer form of that. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, honestly, and I think that, like when you mentioned that ending, I feel like there's honestly a lot of parallels there, at least from how you're describing it with Berserk as a whole, really, but like also with like the, I guess, sort of ending we got with the final chapter, which, I mean, it's not really one of my examples of, like, you know, satisfactory endings, but I feel like...
Well, yeah, it's not really an ending, but yeah, I get what you're saying completely, yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, yeah.
I mean, but yeah, I mean, also, especially with how you describe Inuyashiki, someone who, like, you know, who makes the sacrifice for his, you know, his loved ones, I feel like there's, you know, there I feel like that is reminiscent of Guts to me, you know, someone who, like, you know, I mean... Guts, you know, wouldn't be happy if his loved ones aren't happy, or, you know, aren't at least safe. But you know, he does obviously sacrifice, you know, his well-being really for, you know, the well-being and safety of his, you know, of his loved ones, you know, especially Casca. And yeah. I mean, I feel like, and yeah, I mean, and you know, and I feel like, you know, with the ending, I guess, that we did sort of get with the final chapter, again, there I feel like there was this really sentimental, you know, bittersweet feeling there with, you know, like with Griffith, yeah, like shedding his tears, and you know, it's just like, which it is a cliffhanger, but it's like, you know,
yeah, sorry to interrupt, yeah, you, but I think that's why I think some people, actually quite a few people, quite a large portion of the fan base, the Berserk kind of audience, has openly expressed they wouldn't be unhappy if the series would end here. And some even saying that they would be happier if it ended there. Which is because this bittersweetness is, I think, a common trait amongst a lot of good endings, this bittersweetness. I think a lot of heavily criticized endings involve an extreme of one emotion or the other. Either it's an unrealistic level of kind of positivity that just doesn't make sense considering the events that led up to it, either because of pacing issues or just because it doesn't fit the tone that was established throughout, or it's just ridiculously excessively tragic and just it doesn't make sense. It's numbing. I think that like bittersweetness is, I think in a weird way, kind of like a singularity point that you kind of like a lot of people inevitably come to when they're trying to conclude a story, especially one that attempts at least to introduce some level of complexity and kind of like grayness in a moral and just like in a just like a satisfactory sense, like, you know, because you can't just be morally gray. There's also the capacity of a story to be gray in terms of just its fairness to people. Like, you know, just because a character has done great things and proved that they are amazing in like a moral or just like in a human sense, that doesn't mean that they're going to get, you know, their quote unquote deserved good ending, happy ending. And I think bittersweetness is something that I think a lot of really good endings have in common. I would, you know, say that that's something I mean, that's something I'm sick by for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely for sure. And I think that's, you know, that level of bittersweetness is even sort of echoed in like the examples that I'm about to talk about, which are, you know, the two Watanabe series that I frequently mention, Cowboy Bebop and Samurai Champloo, who both have these, like, you know, sort of sentimental, kind of bittersweet ending, although I think the bittersweetness is definitely more there with Cowboy Bebop, obviously, given the nature of that ending and what happens in it with, you know, Spike the protagonist ultimately, you know, collapsing with it not really being clear, completely clear whether, you know, he lives or dies.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is kind of speculated that, you know, he unfortunately does meet his end. But it does feel, you know, honestly satisfying because, you know, even if, you know, Spike dies and, you know, we know that, like, he doesn't have, you know, anything left after this, we kind of know that, you know, at this point, Spike has just sort of achieved this inner peace, right? I mean, he's dealt with his past, you know, he's faced his, you know, sort of like inner demons, like his inner demons and his, you know, actual, you know, demons in the form of his rival Vicious. And I feel like, you know, him just kind of like, you know, collapsing there and, you know, giving his famous line, you know, "You're gonna carry that weight," bang. And just like, it's like, you know, it just feels like, it just feels so fitting for his character.
Gosh, it was great. Like that final panel, like I think one of the things that sticks up to me about that final key visual is the kind of like searchlight that's just blaring at him. Like, and he's like,
bah. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, even so, it just feels so satisfactory because, you know, it just feels like such an appropriate way for a guy like Spike to go out and you just feel like, you know, now he's at peace, you know, he can just finally rest. Whereas before, you know, he would like take these like, you know, like beatings and like injuries that, you know, most people would probably die from, but because, you know, his soul wasn't at peace in those moments, you know, he just, you know, he kept carrying on and persisted, and, you know, but yeah, and I feel like, and yeah, so moving on to, if I may, to the other, you know, Watanabe series, Samurai Champloo, it feels very satisfactory and you know, somewhat bittersweet because, you know, the protagonist Mugen, Jin, and Fu, it ends with them really just, you know, going their separate ways after their journey, you know, to find the Sunflower Samurai has finished, and it just feels satisfactory because, you know, it's difficult to put in words, but you kind of feel like, you know, yes, it is a bit like, it is somewhat frustrating that, you know, they're going their separate ways after, you know, they've all finally really become friends, ultimately, not just, you know, comrades. But you get this sense, like, you know, they're going their separate ways to, like, you know, just live their lives to the fullest, really, you know, taking the lessons they've learned from their journey together and, you know, just applying that to, you know, wherever they ultimately go in life. And, you know, and who knows, it's nice that, you know, leaves it open-ended to, you know, to them, you know, I mean, you know, as for all we know, they might reunite someday, who knows, and just, I guess, I like that it leaves it sort of, like, open-ended in a satisfactory way that doesn't feel like, you know, it's, you know, it doesn't tie up loose ends, but yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, again, Watanabe is someone I respect because I have watched Bebop and I do need to get to Champloo at some point. I know I keep saying that and I will. But I guess the thing is that, like, you know, it's clear to me. It's a very Watanabe ending, as far as I know, you know, having watched Bebop. I mean, again, it's a bit of a downtoned level of bittersweetness. I guess it's more sweet than bitter, probably. I guess you might agree with that. I guess, I think what's so interesting about that is that it's sort of like, it gives you something to be happy about, but it also gives you something to be unhappy about, but also gives you a reason why it's not logical to be unhappy about it. If you get what I'm saying, like, you know, yeah, it's actually, you should quote unquote, you know, because who's to say, but you should quote unquote be happy for these people because they've gained so much from the story and they're going to use that in their lives most likely, but you can't see that yourself, which is, it's kind of like a slap in the face. It's like, yeah, there's no reason you should know that though. You know, you should be happy for these people. You know, I think that's actually a really cool thing that a lot of other stories do too, but I mean, I'm imagining just knowing Watanabe probably does it very well.
Yeah, definitely, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, like, that's actually a really interesting story because, I mean, Samurai Champloo is a samurai story, and the last example that I had, and I'll mention this quickly because I think we've touched on a lot of what I think is important, and I don't want to drag this out anymore than it has to be, but Blade of the Immortal is a fantastic manga series. I love it very, very much. You know, not just because it is a great narrative piece of work, but also because it touches at a lot of sentimental kind of chords that I think are really, really, really kind of, I guess I'm really sensitive with. And I think a lot of other people are. And it's a very similar ending to what you actually just described, which is interesting, just the parting of two people, deuterogonists, who have been together through basically the entire series, whether, you know, maybe not directly together, but they have depended on each other and come back to each other, being Manji and Ning. Ning being the person who is basically instigated the events of the story, you know, for the most part, by attempting to avenge her family, who was killed by another person who basically Manji is hired to kill for her because Rin herself doesn't have the skills to do so, or simply just, you know, it would be impossible because it's not just this man, it's all of the people who follow him and admire him and, you know, who basically have dedicated themselves and their lives to him. And, you know, she can't take all of that on. She needs Manji there, not just as like a physical, like, you know, weapon, but also as like a soul to be solidaires, like to be solitary with her, and to stand, you know, in the face of this vengeance, which is not morally correct. It just isn't. It is a selfish, basically unjustified act because you have to commit the same crimes as this person has in order to get to them and take your revenge, which is, you know, a perfect morally gray concept that isn't by any means unique to the story. But the fact that at the end, Manji and Rin part. In fact, Manji just basically ghosts Rin in a way that, you know, I think is very typical of him, because he doesn't want to damage this person, Rin, even though he knows he'll hurt her immensely. If when he does this, he knows that those wounds will heal. They're not going to be permanent, because as much as she's attached to him, her life will be much better and much simpler and much more deserving of, you know, her and her goodness, you know, and her whole being as, like, you know, what she has deserved throughout the events of the story than if she were to stay with him. He would only kind of exacerbate her kind of situation, and he doesn't kind of want to put her in such a complex circumstance or set of circumstances that would basically kind of like ruin, or I guess like put a stopper on how happy she could get. And first of all, I think that really exemplifies some sacrifices by Manji. Like, the fact that Manji is able to make that decision is obviously reflective of something that we've known about him all the time, which is that he's decisive and kind of strong-willed in a way that basically has allowed Rin to survive up until now. It's the whole reason they've stuck together. But because of that same glue that held them together, he's now going because he knows that, you know, it's not going to be sustainable. And then he wants to leave off this beautiful chapter of his immortal life mind you, he's basically alive 100 years later in the epilogue. I think it was like 80 years or something like that. In any case, the point being, like, you know, the epilogue, I'll mention that now, I guess, ends with Manji in the Meiji period, where basically him as a samurai, he's irrelevant right now, but he's still immortal. So he's basically just a kind of a wraith wandering this new westernized Japan. And who does he meet? But and this is a really nice twist, not Rin, which is you might have expected, but her descendant. He doesn't even see her. And I think that's like this kind of weird asymptote where like, oh, damn, their fingers were about to touch, but they didn't. And like, I think Manji, for some reason, like sees a certain possession of the grandchild that kind of proves that she is somehow related to Rin. And he hears that she's happy, that she's married, that she's like done all these kind of normal, non-immortal things. And it's satisfying. It's just, it's bittersweet in a lot of the ways that I think the way you described Samurai Champloo's ending seems to me. Yeah. It's like you want them to see each other, but you know that that wouldn't really fit the vibe. I think this is the perfect way to describe it. Yeah. You want something, but it would be stupid. It's the same thing with like you wanting characters to return that have died. Like, no, you don't actually want these characters to come back. Don't do that. Part of the beauty of the character that they have closure, and it's the same for a story. It's part of the beauty of a story that it has closure too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think I like that for sure. There. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, endings are great, but they're hard to pull off, I will say.
I mean, it takes skill. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a reason why people look forward to endings as well. As well as people dread endings because they are going to leave characters and they're also afraid of how the author is going to do that. But at the same time, you know that if a series is ending, some major things are going to happen. You're going to experience some major emotions. And that's something that I don't think a lot of people are not going to kind of be excited for. In any case, that was a really fun episode to record. I really, really enjoyed talking about this topic. We'll be back next week with another top 10. Thanks so much, guys.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in. This was, Quentin said this has been great to talk about. And yeah, I mean, endings are, you know, I mean, they're like the perfect example of, you know, everything good has to come to an end, right? And yet they just can't keep going forever because, you know.
Then they wouldn't be good anymore because you wouldn't have that kind of like the bitterness of the ending to complement the kind of like, I guess, you know, it's like the shadow and the light, right? Again, as cliche as it sounds, if you don't have one, you can't have the other.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, guys. So hopefully you'll be tuning in next week and we really appreciate you. And I guess, you know, another message of this is just like, I know some series are coming to an end right now as well, like Attack on Titan, for example. Keep this in mind, right? Like endings are hard, but there's always something you could probably get out of them. So make sure not to kind of like, I guess, let yourself get caught up in that wave of emotions, not trying to preach or anything like that, but I guess I am. I think that's really important because I think it leads to a lot of very kind of wild, emotionally driven conflicts in communities that just don't reflect the positivity of a series ending and the monument that is that series after it has ended. All right. So we'll see you guys next week and goodbye, strugglers.
Yes, keep struggling.
Yes.